A chuckle burbled in General Schuyler's voice.
Well, that is a pretty situation, isn't it? I'm sorry to say.
In fact, he didn't sound sorry at all.
We're sleeping two to a bedroom as it is, and there's no way we could accommodate you in the house.
He shrugged.
I'll see if Roger can find you something in the barn.
He turned then and strode toward the front hall. Eliza quickly stepped back to avoid being seen. But as she did, one of her slippers brushed against the banister spindle, and an embroidered bead popped off, bouncing onto the floor below. The powdered head turned and tilted upward. A lean face, impossibly young, looked up at hers. It was a sharp face, with a wolf's sly intelligence. Long, straight nose, bright blue eyes. The most uncanny feature, however, had to be the eyebrows. For some reason, Eliza had always thought Alexander Hamilton would be dark-haired, but he was, in fact, a ginger, and one who seemed to have a perpetual look of mischief on his face, even now, after he had just had his own head served to him on a platter. The rumors were right. Alexander Hamilton was terribly handsome. Having been seen, she drew herself erect, then made her way down the stairs as regally as she could. With each step, Colonel Hamilton's face grew as red as his eyebrows, as he realized that she was a Schuyler daughter and that she'd overheard his exchange with her father. "Colonel Hamilton," she said, without looking him in the eye, and swept past him into the party. 5. Tomcat and Canary. Schuyler Ballroom, Albany, New York, November 1777. After his rough treatment by General Schuyler at the back door of the mansion, and the dazzling apparition of the Schuyler daughter floating down the stairs, Alex skulked in the rear foyer for a few minutes so that it wouldn't appear as if he were following her. He wondered who she was. Was it Angelica, whom Kitty had said was the boldest of the daughters? Or Peggy, the prettiest? Or could it be Eliza herself, of whom Kitty had so often spoken? Whoever it was, the look she had given him cut him deeper than anything the general had said. That wasn't his only trouble at the moment. He didn't usually affect a wig, but he'd put one on this morning. Not for the meeting with General Schuyler, but in anticipation of the ball tonight, news of which had been all over Albany since he arrived 3 days earlier. He had fiddled with the pins for 10 minutes before giving up, and had spent the entire day with the distinct impression that his hair was on crooked. Plus, it itched. Unfortunately, it was impossible to get a finger beneath the thick layer of hair without sending the hairpiece even more askew. But if he didn't scratch his head soon, he was going to end up ripping the thing off and pulling his own hair out of his head. He looked around for a mirror but didn't see one, so he squinted into a pane of the back door. He'd managed to worm his fingers under the wig without dislodging it too much, but just as he started to scratch, the door swung open, and a servant's face appeared where Alex's reflection had been. Alex recognized him as Roger, the general's valet, who had attended him in his office.
Oh, excuse me, Alex said sheepishly, jerking his hands from his head and feeling the wig grow even more crooked.
Roger was perhaps 30 years old, a slim, regal man whose confident bearing suggested he was well aware how dependent his master was on him and not afraid to exploit his power. He smirked now, either at the thought of a young man asking his pardon or, more likely, at the mess that was at the top of Alex's head.
"Allow me, sir."
Alex was about to step out of Roger's way, but instead the valet reached his hands to Alex's head, and before Alex quite knew what was happening, had deftly slipped his fingers beneath the wig and began to knead his itching scalp.
Oh, my stars, Alex said when he could speak again. That feels wonderful.
It is a task I have performed for the general on occasion, Roger said, his fingers giving Alex's scalp one last squeeze, then slipping out from the wig and quickly, professionally, fastening it back in place.
There you are, sir. You look like you could conquer anything now, whether it's the British or...
He nodded his head at the room behind Alex.
A ballroom full of bells.
Without another word, he slipped past Alex and disappeared into the house. A burst of laughter from the door beyond him shook Alex from his trance, and he reminded himself there was a ball to get to. Smoothing his jacket, he squared his shoulders and marched into the party. The jovial roar of voices struck him as soon as he entered. There were at least 30 people in the grand hall, and judging from the sound, at least that many scattered in the pair of opulent parlors that opened off each end. About a third of their number were men, equally divided between gray-haired ancients too old to fight, and young men like him in smart blue uniforms who were on leave or perhaps stationed to the local garrison. But the bulk of the party guests were women. Seated grand dames who spread their billowing skirts around their chairs and ottomans like fountains spilling over their basins and forcing their conversation partners to stand well back. The eyes of these half-dozen, femmes d'une certaine âge, scanned the room as if hawks in search of prey, looking for suitable mates for their daughters. And then there were the young ladies themselves, their waists cinched and their cleavage pushed up high and proud, who made up almost half the room's number. Elaborate skirts cocooned each one of them in a richly colored aura, all of which set off their ghostly powdered complexions and the mountainous silver wigs perched atop their heads. Yet no amount of powder and makeup could hide the desperation in their eyes. With so many of the local boys away at war, there was almost no prey for this pack of fierce and brightly colored predators to track down and capture. Alex felt at least a dozen pairs of eyes fasten on him as he walked into the room. He stood up a little straighter, glad that his wig was on right. Perhaps the night wasn't going to be so bad after all. A half hour found Alex seated in a parlor whose tall windows offered a spectacular view of the Hudson River and the lights of Albany on its far bank. Six girls stood in a fan around him, their colorful skirts arrayed like a mountain range decked out in fall foliage, topped by the first dusting of winter snows. If only their names were as delicate as their faces and figures. Alas, they all seemed afflicted with strange Dutch and English names like Vanderschnitzel or Tenbreek, which is what his fingers nearly did when the girl shook his hand with a grip like a milkmaid at her chores, or Beaverbroke, which Alex had made its owner repeat 3 times to see if she were having him on.
"Oh, Colonel Hamilton," said a Miss Tambling Goggin, or Tamblin Gogging, he wasn't sure which. "How utterly fascinating it is that you work with General Washington himself. It must be so exciting."
Alex shrugged. "I wouldn't say it's exciting as much as dangerous," he said, his bright blue eyes flashing. He knew how to play to this crowd. A collective gasp from the gaggle of girls.
"I can't imagine anything more frightening than a battlefield,"
cooed a Miss Van Leeuwenwort, whom Alex was calling Liverwurst in his head.
"The roar of the cannon and the smell of smoke and the cries of men in mortal ecstasy."
Alex didn't mean Liverwurst as an insult, by the way. It was one of his favorite foods, and he hadn't had any in ages. In fact, while Alex had been in battle, he mostly served away from the front lines. Though the general always risked life and limb with his men, he often left his less experienced aide-de-camp behind, a fact that made Alex feel like he was shirking his duty. But that wasn't his fault.
and the image of his taking notes while fellow soldiers dodged musket fire and cannon balls or rushed toward the enemy with drawn swords wasn't going to loosen any of these ladies' bodices.
"Ah, yes, mortal ecstasy," he said, looking into the middle distance as if recalling unsayable scenes of carnage. "It can indeed overpower the senses."
"As does the rich odor of India ink, filling the nostrils with its terrible intimations of sealing wax and postage stamps."
Alex looked up just as a new wig appeared among the peaks, looming like an iceberg emerging from an ocean fog. It crowned a long, magnificently sculptured face that would have been almost too severe but for the exuberance of a set of full, richly rouged lips, which were set in a smirk of private amusement.
"It is indeed a rich... what?"
he asked. "Oh, one can imagine the terrible pain of a hand cramping after measureless hours curled around the barbarous scimitar of a raptor's quill."
Alex turned to see a second new face, her glorious emerald eyes set off by a seafoam gown. This beauty was without a wig, though the dark locks had been piled nearly as high as any of the other girls' pompadours. Her face was softer than that of the India ink jokester, yet there was a familial resemblance. He began to get a bad feeling in the pit of his stomach, as sweat beaded beneath his own laughable wig. He managed a weak chuckle.
"Ladies, you have caught me. I do indeed spend many hours serving as General Washington's amanuensis, assisting him with his communications with..."
"Amanuensis!"
A third feminine voice cut him off. He turned to see the girl from the stairs, dressed in a simple gown unamplified by hoops. As his eyes darted between the three girls, he realized he'd been ambushed by none other than the beautiful and clever Schuyler sisters. An image of Fort Ticonderoga besieged on all sides sprang to his mind. The ladies, who made up his breathless entourage of powdered hair and high heels, glanced at one another peevishly before petulantly making room for the three newcomers. It wasn't just that this was the Schuylers' house, Alex thought. These three were clearly used to commanding any room they entered.
"Amanuensis is such an impressive-sounding word,"
said the one he'd bumped into by the stairs. She stood in the middle of her siblings, glowing with good health, a little shorter than the one, a little taller than the other, and yet more vibrant than either, despite the plainness of her gown.
"It must refer to some tremendously important position, like a bombardier or a charioteer."
A blush crept over Alex's cheeks.
"There are no charioteers in the Continental Army, Miss, Schuyler, I presume?"
"He is correct, Eliza. The position is not as lofty as one might assume,"
said the first sister, the one with the sculptural face.
"It is, of course, outside of the domestic purview of provincial females such as ourselves. But I do think what the word amanuensis describes is a position more akin to a scrivener." "What's that you say, Ange?"
the other sister said.
"Scribbler?"
"Scribbler is a good word, Peg," the second sister, Eliza, answered. "And yet, scribbler is a name often applied to novelists, who, after all, are the authors of the words they scratch onto the page. Whereas, an amanuensis is more of a copyist. Don't you think, Angelica?"
"Indeed,"
the tallest sister answered.
"It is a position rather akin to a ventriloquist's mannequin, who simply mouths the words of his master."
"There's another word for mannequin, isn't there?"
Peggy asked.
"Dolt or dummkopf or
dummy,"
Eliza filled in, looking directly at Alex.
"I think that's the word you're looking for."
It was a rout, and revenge against what she had heard at the back landing. They were angry and defending their father from this court-martial, and they were out to shoot the messenger. Alex looked up at the three faces arranged determinedly before him. Elegant Angelica on the left, pretty Peggy on the right, and in the middle, the most bewitching of the three, seeming to combine the best features of both sisters and yet not resembling either of them. Angelica and Peggy were both lovely girls, but their beauty emanated from their visages. Eliza was certainly lovely as well, yet her distinction, her captivating quality, came from within rather than without. He had eyes only for Eliza as he pulled a handkerchief from his coat pocket and waved it in the air.
"I surrender," he said weakly. "Do with me what you will."
Eliza stared back at him for a long moment, a triumphant smile flickering at the edge of her lips. Then she reached out and, as if she were plucking a flower, pulled the handkerchief from Alex's hand. Examining it as though she'd never before seen a man's lace-edged pocket handkerchief, she tucked it into her cleavage. "He's all yours, ladies," she said to the Misses Tenbrake, Vanderschnitzel, Beaverbrook, Tamblyn Gogging, and Van Leeuwenwort. She turned her back on him, her voice dripping with contempt. "Do with him what you will." Six. Lovers Real. Schuyler Ballroom, Albany, New York, November 1777. At length, the victuals had been consumed, another round of cider and whiskey quaffed, the chit-chat dispensed with. A small army of footmen and stable boys suddenly appeared from the door beneath the stairs, and in a matter of minutes had cleared the great hall of all its furniture. As the last sideboard was carted out, the musicians, who had been playing quietly in the red room, took their place at the foot of the ballroom, a trio consisting of violin, viola, and cello. While the players were taking their places, the guests lined up on either side of the long gallery, and then Mrs. Schuyler separated herself from the crowd and stepped out into the center of the room. "Ladies and gentlemen," she said with the air of a born master of ceremony, "it is time to dance." A smatter of applause. Mrs. Schuyler waited for it to die down. "In this time of war," she said, "it is more important than ever that we not lose sight of the traditions that bind us together as a nation and the pleasures that we fight for as people. Hence this small party, which my husband and I throw in honor of the many brave men who fight for our new nation and the stalwart young women who assist them on the home front." As Mrs. Schuyler spoke, Eliza was busy retrieving her dance card from the credenza in the southwest parlor. Normally, a girl carried her card with her. But on this occasion, her mother had revived an old tradition of the female guests leaving their cards on a table so that any gentleman could pencil himself in without fear of rejection. Eliza knew Mrs. Schuyler did this less out of a love of tradition, but rather to make it impossible for her three headstrong daughters to turn down someone their mother thought would make a fine catch. "As a mother," Mrs. Schuyler continued, "I am quite honestly relieved that my sons, John and Philip, are too young to go to battle. But I am also equally proud of the remarkable contributions to the war effort made by my three eldest daughters." "Hear, hear," the murmur of her guests' approval interrupted her, but not for long. "Angelica, Eliza, Peggy, would you please join me?" Just as Mrs. Schuyler called her name, Eliza spotted her card and snatched it up without reading any of the names written on it. She hurried into the ballroom where the crowd was dutifully applauding the famed Schuyler girls and skipped out into the open space near her two sisters. As she took her place between Angelica
resplendent in her amber gown, and Peggy, dazzling in seafoam green, she felt a small pang of regret for not deigning to wear the burgundy gown. Between two such fierce beauties, she felt a little like a servant girl, and only her sister's hands in hers kept her from cringing into the shadows. When the applause died down, the sisters began to move back to the sidelines.
"Peggy," Mrs. Schuyler called, "would you wait a moment?"
Peggy pretended to gasp and look surprised, but it was clear she knew what was happening.
"Angelica and Eliza have both made their official appearances before," Mrs. Schuyler said to the crowd. "But as this is Peggy's first ball as a young woman, I am foregoing my right to have the first dance to give it to my daughter. It is not quite a coming-out ball, for such a celebration would be untoward in times of war. Nevertheless, we can at least let her have her turn in the lights. Peggy, pray, tell us the name of the gentleman who has the honor of sharing your first dance."
Peggy eagerly pulled her card from her reticule, a beaming smile on her face. Her smile flickered as she looked at the name at the top of the page.
Stephen, she stuttered. "Stephen Van Rensselaer."
A great roar of applause went up, even as Eliza found Angela's and Peggy's eyes and shared in their shock. Stephen Van Rensselaer III was the eldest son of Stephen II. The Van Rensselaers were distant cousins on Mrs. Schuyler's side and the wealthiest family in northern New York State. In every way, Stephen III was the most eligible bachelor north of Albany. Every way but one, that is. A tall, thin boy in an exquisitely cut suit of midnight blue overcoat and dove-gray breeches detached himself from the crowd. Despite his height, however, and the color of his coat, he was no soldier for one simple reason. He was barely into his teens. The eighth patroon of the largest estate in all of New York was all of 14 years old. Eliza felt a hand on hers and turned to see Angelica. "I sense Mama's handiwork here," her older sister said, even as the band struck the first notes, and Peggy and Stephen took their places at the end of the room. Stephen's face was fine enough and might one day be handsome, but at the moment he looked like a stick doll in a suit, and Stephen had always been quiet and fumbling for words. A curious sort of fellow with a fondness for birding, he had earned himself the reputation of a loner.
"Stephen is at least 4 years younger than Peggy," Eliza said indignantly.
Their families had sat across from each other at the Dutch Reformist Church for years as the children grew up.
"Four? I think it is more like 5. Isn't he only a year older than Johnny?" sniffed Angelica.
Eliza nodded, thinking it was a bit strange indeed, watching the gawky young man dance with the belle of the ball in front of a cheering, or was it jeering, crowd.
"It doesn't matter, does it? He is the richest single male in our circle, and we are the 3 marriageable daughters of a family fallen on hard times," said Angelica. "Oh, dear," she gasped, as Peggy and Stephen danced past them down the line, a strained grace on her sister's face, a look of dogged terror on Stephen's.
"She is leading him. She is leading him," she hissed.
"Let's hope the engagement is a long one," Eliza said with a sad laugh.
She pulled out her own card to see whom her mother had arranged for her to dance with first, and soon she was as aggrieved as her sister. A small gasp escaped her lips.
"It can't be."
"What?" Angelica asked. "Who is it?"
"Major Andre." "John Andre? That is insane, even by Mama's standards."
Major John Andre was a British loyalist, born in London to wealthy French Huguenot parents,
whose ancestors, like so many Americans, had fled religious persecution in France. Before the revolution began, he and General Schuyler had served in the British Army together, and André had been a favorite of their father's. Indeed, he was said to charm everyone he met, with his easy conversation in English and French, and his ability to dash off the most remarkable likenesses in pen and ink, and above all, with his guileless brown eyes and open, honest expression set in a broad, handsome face. But when the colonies declared independence, he had chosen to fight for the country that had taken in his own family when they had fled France. Such was General Schuyler's honor and fond memories of serving with André that he said he could not condemn the major's decision, and even went so far as to declare that he would be most aggrieved if circumstances forced him to shoot the dashing young officer. But that still didn't explain what he was doing on Eliza's dance card. "How is he even here? Why is Papa not arresting him, or shooting him?" asked Eliza. Apparently, Major André was commissioned on a diplomatic mission to General Gates, for which he was granted safe passage up and down river, said Angelica. It had to do with the prisoner exchange for General Burgoyne and his transport to New York so that he can be sent back to England. When Papa found out he was in Albany, he invited him to dine. I declare, Papa's chivalry will be the death of us all. But chivalry wasn't why my mama let him sign my dance card. She is punishing me. For the dress, no doubt. Who do you have after him? Eliza looked down and turned paler. Colonel Hamilton. This time, Angelica exclaimed loudly enough that people turned and looked at them. In a quieter voice, she added, How could Mama do that, especially after his meeting with Papa? Eliza shrugged. She knew full well how to incur her mother's wrath. How did you fare? She asked Angelica. Her sister held out her card with a smile. Only one name was written on it, albeit 8 times, for every single dance of the evening. Mr. John Barker Church. What? Eliza exclaimed. How did you pull that off? Simple, Angelica answered. I was not foolish enough to leave my card out for Mama to commandeer. Not my first time at the ball, she added mischievously, flashing a little smile to Mr. Church himself, who stood on the far side of the room, patiently awaiting his dance. John Church was almost a decade older than Angelica. Like Major André, he was British-born and had only arrived in North America a few years earlier. Unlike Major André, though, he espoused the revolutionary cause. But he also refused to renounce his British citizenship. And this, coupled with the fact that when he first arrived in the colonies, he set up business under the alias John Carter, made many suspicious of his character. General Schuyler had said straight out that he thought Church was a gambler and a spy, and scented something devious about his business methods. However, Mrs. Schuyler, knowing her daughter's fondness for Church, as well as hearing stories about Church's growing fortune, had insisted he be allowed to attend the ball. "Until we have proof against him, civility directs us to be for him," she said diplomatically. And as General Schuyler valued decorum above all things in human society, he had reluctantly assented. Eliza looked over at her sister's paramour. He was not what she would call ugly, but he was far from handsome. He was shorter than Angelica, for one thing, and rather thick through the waist, and his face always had a rather silly-looking smile on it, especially when he looked at Eliza's older sister, as he'd been doing all evening. "Tell me again what you see in him, Ange, besides his fortune, I mean," she asked her older sister. "I refuse to be an ornament in a gilded cage," said Angelica, lifting her chin.
And while a pretty face is nice to wake up to, an adoring face is so much more rewarding. Church talks to me like an equal and is grateful for my affection. I need never worry about him stepping out on me, and yes, his fortune is a most welcome quality.
Papa will never allow it, though, Eliza warned. You know how he feels about the man.
We shall see, said Angelica.
And Eliza knew her sister was determined to change their father's mind about her unsuitable suitor. Eliza sighed, even as the first song came to an end. Sometimes her sister's pragmatism was too similar to her mother's. While Eliza professed no outward interest in romance, at heart she yearned to experience a lush, sweeping love affair of her own. She was about to ask Angelica if she'd seen Major Andre when she was tapped on the shoulder. She turned to face a fine-looking gentleman whose thick brown hair was pulled back from a high brow, his rich chocolate-colored eyes staring into hers.
"Miss Schuyler," a suave British voice announced, "I believe I have the honor of this dance."
Eliza's heart turned a little somersault. She had heard stories of how good-looking Major Andre was, but she had not been prepared for this. He was the picture of debonair in his dashing suit, which, though not a uniform, wearing his red coat here probably would have gotten him shot in a duel, was still sharply cut in a rich burgundy and accented with polished gold buttons and lace at collar and cuffs. She felt as though she were staring into a painting by Sir Joshua Reynolds. She curtsied politely. "A pleasure to make your acquaintance."
"The pleasure is all mine," Major Andre said, leading her into position directly behind Angelica and John Church. "May I compliment you on your appearance this evening? You are among the brightest flowers here."
Eliza couldn't quite stifle her laugh. "No need to flatter me, Major Andre. I am aware that my dress is a little drab this evening."
The Major turned to look at her directly.
"Your dress?" he said smoothly. "I hadn't noticed it."
His eyes never left hers.
"I'm sure it is the loveliest in the room."
The music started, saving Eliza from having to answer. For the next 15 minutes, she danced the line with her partner, whose light touch deftly guided her in the turns and twists and bows, without ever once overpowering her. Because it was a quadrille, they kept spinning away from each other and coming back, dancing side by side and then turning to face each other. It was a complicated set of maneuvers, one that Eliza had spent many hours learning, and though she went through her paces gracefully, she always felt a little nervous, lest she make a misstep and bring the coordinated roomful of dancers to a crashing log jam. Yet every time she felt a twinge of anxiety, she found Major Andre's hand in hers, or his eyes on hers, and he deftly set her to rights. If, at the end of the dance, he had asked her to run away with him, she might have exclaimed, "Long live the king!" and run all the way to the docks by his side. But before she knew it, the music faded out, and Major Andre was bowing to her.
"It was like dancing with a dove," he said. "I felt as though you carried me up and down the room."
"Oh, Major Andre," Eliza said, blushing. "You are too kind." It was not the most original line, but it was all she could come up with, rattled by how charming she found him.
Eliza caught Angelica's gaze across the dance floor as she was bowing to the handsome British adjutant, and her sister shot her a wink and a little smile. Then Angelica threw back her shoulders in an exaggerated signal to encourage her sister to lift her chest in a more enticing pose. Eliza quickly followed suit, because big sisters know a thing or two. And then he was gone, and a white powdered wig took his place,
capping a pair of russet eyebrows and piercing, amused blue eyes. Alexander Hamilton looked as surprised as she was to be asking her to dance.
"Miss Schuyler, I hope my name on your dance card wasn't too alarming, but your mother said she would make me sleep in the barn if I didn't sign up."
Eliza refused to acknowledge him just long enough to make him squirm, then finally took his hand and allowed herself to be led back to the head of the room. "I hate to be the bearer of bad news," she said as they walked, "but she's going to have you sleep in the barn anyway."
"Ah."
Alex's voice was cut off by the first strains of a reel. Almost reluctantly, he offered her his hand, and Eliza put her gloved fingers into it, as though reaching into a pail of sour milk for a ring that had fallen. Yet she couldn't help but note that his hand had a sure and confident touch, light and attentive, and, if she was being honest, not completely repulsive. It irritated her, this confidence, and so she sought to undermine it. "Colonel Hamilton, if you please," she said, adjusting herself beneath his grip, "I am not an apple on the tree to be tested for ripeness. If you could perhaps squeeze a little less tightly, I have worn corsets that took less liberty." Alex's eyes went wide, and his fingers, which barely rested on her shoulder and waist, relaxed still more.
"I do apologize,"
he said in a voice so aggrieved that she felt a twinge of guilt. They began to move to the music. Alex's step was as assured as Major Andre's had been, but Eliza deliberately dragged her feet a little, so that he was forced to hurry her along to keep them from bumping into the other couples on the dance floor. A smile remained on his face, but it was a little strained. They whirled by Major Andre, who had his hand in Henrietta Beaverbrook's. Eliza tried to catch his eye, but the music called for a whirl, and they swept away from each other. Again, Eliza found herself face to face with the colonel's handsome but increasingly strained face. Spots of sweat had appeared on his temples beneath his periwig.
"I wonder that your parents would allow you to dance with a British officer," he said, nodding at the major.
Eliza frowned and did not answer.
"Miss Schuyler, have I offended you in some way?" he asked suddenly.
The dance took them away from each other for a moment, and when he was back, he continued.
"If so, I do apologize. I can assure you that my errand today is as odious to me as it is to General Schuyler, for whom I have only the utmost respect."
"You have a strange way of showing it, then," Eliza shot back. But again, she felt a little badly for her partner. His voice was genuinely full of concern, and her own father had told her innumerable times that war forced Ben to make compromises that in any other circumstances would be intolerable. But she didn't care. He had insulted her father's honor, and she didn't care if he was the most handsome soldier at the ball— much more handsome than even the British major, she had to admit. He would have to do a lot more than offer a de rigueur apology to get back in her good graces. The colonel seemed about to say something more, but the dance called for a particularly complicated set of turns, bows and weavings, and they were both forced to concentrate to move through them smoothly. But as they came to the end of the maneuver, their path brought them close to Major Andre and Henrietta. Eliza's eyes caught those of the dashing British soldier, who flashed her a smile, and she fell behind a half-step. As she ducked beneath Alex's arm, her heel came down squarely on the bridge of her partner's foot. Alex gasped, but he managed to repress a yelp. When they were face to face again, she glanced at him with equal measures of guilt and glee. Normally, when a gentleman's foot interposes itself between his partner's and the floor, he apologizes for being so clumsy, she said, in the kind of imperious voice that would have made Angelica proud.
"Did you drive the sharp wooden heel of your shoe into the top of my foot, threatening to break my arch?" he asked in the lightest possible tone. "I didn't notice."
Eliza couldn't help it. She smiled. And when he unexpectedly threw in an unscripted bound instead of the expected coupé, she let out the tiniest of whoops, and would have fallen if his strong arm hadn't pressed firmly into the small of her back.
"I beg your pardon," he said when she was upright again. "I didn't mean to leave you hanging."
She had to hand it to him. He was good, this Alexander Hamilton. Under other circumstances, she might actually like him. But right now, she had about 7 more minutes of his time, and she was determined to make them as difficult as possible. 7. Gauntlet or Handkerchief Thrown. Schuyler Ballroom, Albany, New York, November 1777. As the night wore on, the frenzied pace of the dancing picked up. The officers' uniforms flashed with medals and a few gold braids. More than a snippet of petticoats could be glimpsed as the turns grew wilder and the men's hands around the ladies' waists began to intentionally miss their marks to hold on to something more interesting. Soon the ballroom grew overly warm despite the mid-November chill. After taking his leave and bowing to Eliza Schuyler, Alex went back to drinking mulled cider from the Schuyler orchards, spiked with apple brandy from the pasture's own trees, and followed that, perhaps a bit unwisely, with French wine spiced with cinnamon and cloves. In between dancing reel after reel with the eligible young ladies of Albany, he went back to regaling perfumed clouds of girls who clustered around him like life-sized lollipops, with stories of battlefield valor and carnage. Taking advantage of the general's lavish hospitality, he then stepped into the smoking room to indulge in fine Virginia cigars and whiskey brewed beyond the Kentucky frontier, before intrepidly accepting a slug of some home-brewed spirit that unfortunately tasted like serpent's urine. At last, he returned to the ballroom and found himself once again surrounded by a clique of girls. Well, 2 girls. From the 8 who had fawned on him earlier in the evening, the Misses Vanderschnitzel, Tenbrake, and Beaverbroke were all standing in a corner, waiting for their chance to dance with the British adjutant, one Major André, who seemed to have won the hearts of all the ladies that evening. But the loyal Mrs. Tambling Goggin and Van Liverwurst eyed Alex flirtatiously above their fans. They were comely lasses, to be sure. The kind he would have happily spent the time with back in Morristown or Elizabeth. Yet his eyes rolled right over them and shifted back to the dance floor. For there were the Schuyler sisters, the undisputed queens of the party. Angelica, regal and self-possessed, even next to her less-than-graceful partner, a short and portly but jolly-looking older gentleman. And Peggy, laughing vivaciously and looking as though she were dancing with a French count, rather than an awkward lad, the young Van Rensselaer heir. But above all, there was Eliza, wearing a dress more suited to the schoolroom than the ballroom, who had insulted his name and rank at every turn, and had even stepped on his foot, and who made him want nothing more than for her to step on the other. Why was it he couldn't take his eyes off the one girl who failed to notice his impressive gifts? What was it about the sharp-tongued lass wearing a homespun gown, a modest cotton dress that touched his heart in its bold demonstration of her alliance to the patriot cause? And why on earth was she dancing for the 3rd time with that blasted British officer, Major André?
"I say, Colonel Hamilton, if you would like to return to the dance floor, I would be happy to join you,"
Miss Tambling Goggin said, sounding anything but pleased. After all, no girl likes to flirt with a boy whose eyes keep wandering away. "I do apologize, but I am quite satisfied where I am. Please do not take my fatigue as a sign of lack of interest in your considerable charms," he said, flashing her a winning but rueful smile.
"Since the colonel is unwilling," said a male voice, "perhaps you will allow me to shepherd you to the dance floor."
The speaker was another man whom Alex didn't recognize, and who, despite being in his early 20s, wasn't wearing a uniform. He was a tall, well-built man, though his soft neck and softer stomach spoke of a fondness for food and alcohol that were clearly getting the better of him, judging from the way he swayed back and forth. In fact, Alex was wondering whether the man had been drunk when he got dressed, because he was wearing one white and one brown hose beneath his expensive velvet breeches.
"So what do you say, Letitia?"
he slurred. Miss Tambling Goggin turned toward the new speaker.
"Alas, but like the Colonel, I am quite satisfied with where I am as well."
"Don't be that way. Come now," said the rude stranger.
"The lady has made her preference known," said Alex mildly.
"Yet I shall make her preference for her, Mr.—"
Alex held out his hand, hoping to diffuse the suddenly tense situation.
"It is Colonel Hamilton, actually. I do not believe I have had the pleasure of making your acquaintance."
The man looked down at Alex's hand, but didn't shake it. Only then did Alex notice that he was leaning heavily on a cane, and then, looking farther down, he saw that the brown hose was not actually cloth. It was a wooden leg.
"I would shake your hand, Colonel, but as you can see, my right hand is otherwise engaged,"
the man said with a dramatic sigh.
"I do beg your pardon, sir,"
Alex said as the music stopped. He noticed Eliza, Angelica, Peggy, and their dance partners heading their way. A half-dozen pairs of eyes were trained on him, and he felt like a complete cad.
"A war injury?"
"Indeed. Some of us haven't spent the past year and a half writing letters in an office. We spent it on the battlefield."
He snorted.
"It's quite ironic when you consider it. Normally, you would expect the person of high-born rank—that's me, by the way," he added contemptuously. "Normally, you would expect the son of gentry to shirk the battlefield. But in this case, it is the nobody commoner who flees glory and hides behind a clerical duty or some other equally flimsy excuse, while the nobleman defends his country's honor. But then, it isn't really your country now, is it? Where were you born again? An island off the coast of nowhere?"
The man sneered, as the Schuyler girls and their companions clustered around their little group. Alex felt his cheeks go red, and had to resist the urge to throw down his glove for a challenge, or just punch the man outright. No matter how important his work as aide-de-camp and ambassador for General Washington, his spending the war doing various non-combat jobs was a source of great shame to him. He wanted to risk life and limb for this country, which, though he hadn't been born here and had only lived on its shores for a few years, had nevertheless embraced him and inspired him with its ideals and potential. Only the fact that the man speaking so rudely to him was an injured veteran stayed his hand.
I do apologize," Alex said again, letting the slur against his birthplace go. "Your country owes you a debt of honor."
"Yes, it does. Whereas all it owes you is a paycheck."
"Oh, put a cork in it, Peterson," said a young male voice.
He turned to see Stephen Van Rensselaer rolling his eyes.
"Everybody knows you got injured when you stabbed yourself in the ankle with your own bayonet while you were loading your gun, and then you fell down drunk in a latrine and got it infected so that it had to be amputated. The mules who pull cannons serve their country more usefully than you do."
Peterson looked distinctly outraged, but before he could speak, Angelica's partner chimed in.
"Indeed, Peterson," said John Church. "Colonel Hamilton's contribution to the war effort is known throughout the 13 states,
he corrected himself with a wry smile,
"and across the pond in England, France, and Germany. While we must never make light of bravery under fire, the skill it takes to load and shoot a gun is not a rare one,
whereas the ability to address generals and diplomats, and indeed kings, is a truly singular gift. Hence General Washington's unwillingness to surrender his most valuable asset to the battlefield.
Thank you, good sir, said Alex.
John Church, a pleasure to make your acquaintance, said Church, as Angelica looked at him fondly.
But that was the straw that broke Peterson. He whirled drunkenly on John Church.
You, a lobster back! You dare to insult me in my own house?
Eliza, who had been silent throughout the whole exchange, spoke up.
Actually, Mr. Peterson, Mr. Church is not a soldier and hence does not wear a red coat. And pray I remind you, the pastures is my father's house.
Peterson looked confused.
Well, in my own country, then. The Petersons have been respected landowners in the Hudson Valley for more than a century.
Actually, Peterson, young Van Rensselaer drawled, not so very awkward anymore. Your land belongs to my father, ever since you gambled away your income at gaming houses in New York City. You own no more land than Colonel Hamilton. No offense, Colonel.
None taken, said Alex,
feeling gratified at the swelling of support from Angelica's and Peggy's companions.
Peterson sputtered so hard that Alex was afraid he was going to fall over.
Oh, who cares what you think, Rensselaer? You're merely a Dutchman. My family are British through and through.
I thought you didn't like the British,
Eliza's partner, Major Andre, said smoothly.
You are fighting a war against us, after all.
Peterson's jaw dropped. He lifted his cane as if to strike the major, but the movement caused him to lose his balance on his wooden leg, and Alex had to steady him.
Careful there, Peterson. Unhand me. Why, to be insulted in this manner by people who are on the raw edge of respectable.
An ugly sneer covered his face as he turned his attention to Eliza.
And you, girl, if your mother thinks you will make a rich match, she's sorely mistaken. No one is interested in a girl afflicted with intellect and opinion and a small dowry. It's why you only have a red coat and a clerk as your dance partners this evening.
There was a shocked silence from the assembled, until Alex spoke, his words cold as the first frost.
You will apologize to the lady. Apologize? For telling the truth? Peterson sputtered. Why? Is she your paramour? Is that it? Oh, Colonel Hamilton, do not protest. Everyone has noticed your interest in the girl. You can barely take your eyes off her.
Alex's grip on the man's arm became a vice, as Eliza's cheeks flushed with embarrassment and anger.
Nonsense. My interest is purely to redeem something the gentle lady has been holding for me. I assure you it is most businesslike in nature, he said, lying through his teeth.
A fine story,
sneered Peterson, practically apoplectic and sweating all over the place.
But a true one, said Eliza, her cheeks reddening uncontrollably. However, Colonel, I apologize, as I do not have your handkerchief on my person.
Nevertheless, said Alex, turning to Peterson, you will apologize to the lady.
Fine, fine, my apologies. There.
Oh, dear, Mr. Peterson, said John Church. You seem to have exerted yourself.
Here, said Angelica, speaking of handkerchiefs, I believe Mr. Peterson needs one.
And she reached into the pockets of her dress and handed one over to him.
Thank you, my dear, said Church, and he used the handkerchief to pat down Peterson's face as if he were a little baby.
Peterson grabbed the handkerchief and waved it in Church's face for a moment, before his hand fell and he stuffed it in his pocket. Publicly humiliated, he shook Alex off and stormed away in a huff, the butt of his cane striking the floor hard above the music.
Oh, dear, that's going to do beastly things to Mama's floor, Peggy lamented.
Eliza turned to Alex.
Thank you, she said quietly.
It is an honor to come to your defense, he said with deep sincerity, his heart hammering under his uniform.
And I must commend you on your restraint. An ugly situation could have grown much uglier had you not shown such decorum.
Alex smiled. Those are the kindest words I've heard all evening.
Eliza looked as if she was going to take them back, but she held his gaze and didn't look away from him.
He wished he could tell her how he really felt, but somehow he understood it would not be welcome at this juncture.
Alex stepped back with a gentlemanly bow, watching Eliza walk away on the arm of the British major. Hours later, the party finally came to its end, and Alex retreated from the ballroom only to run into Roger, General Schuyler's valet, under the stairs. The servant offered to help him to his accommodations for the evening.
If you'll follow me, sir.
Roger turned to the back door and headed outside. Alex realized with a start that he really was going to sleep in the barn tonight. Roger guided him across the slippery gravel paths by the light of a single flickering lantern, whose glow was swallowed up by a heavy clinging fog coming from the river. The dim light made it that much harder to negotiate the gravel, which rolled like marbles beneath his shoes. The interior of the lofty barn at the foot of the hill was no less cold than the November night outside, and reeked of a pungent mixture of manures. Horse and cow and pig and sheep and chicken. Roger led him down the barn's center aisle to a ladder whose upper reaches were lost in the darkness of the rafters. He pointed upward, indicating that Alex's bed lay somewhere up there.
With the house so full of guests, Mrs. Schuyler was unable to find a spare blanket. But there's plenty of hay,
Roger said without sarcasm. He'd seen worse.
The boys will be in to milk the cows at dawn. That's about 3 hours from now. Perhaps one of them will give you a ladle or two before you have to be on your way.
Alex nodded wearily.
Oh, and before I forget, I was told to give this to you.
Roger handed him a note folded with cloth. Without another word, the valet turned and made his way back down the aisle. With a start, Alex realized it was his handkerchief, the one that he had surrendered to Eliza Schuyler earlier that evening, the same one she had tucked into her bosom. It smelled like her perfume, and he inhaled its sweet scent, bringing it to his nose just as a scrap of paper fluttered out of it. In the dim light of Roger's retreating lantern, he saw a few words in a flowery woman's handwriting. Wait for me, the hayloft, after the ball. Alex stared at the note. A midnight assignation? In the hayloft? With Eliza Schuyler? Was he reading this correctly? He looked around, as if the note writer might be nearby. But just then, Roger opened the barn door and stepped outside. When the door closed behind him, the last of the lantern light disappeared, and Alex couldn't see past his nose. And it wasn't just the rafters that were dark. The entire barn was pitch black. Thankfully, he'd put a hand on the ladder to hold himself steady, or he didn't think he'd have been able to find it, and would have had to sleep beside whatever animal occupied the nearest stall. But after a couple of swings with his foot, he found the first rung and slowly started to climb, somehow managing not to fall. The whole time his heart was beating in his chest at the thought of that marvelous girl making her way up to join him. He wasn't aware that he'd reached the end of the ladder until he found himself tumbling forward into a surprisingly soft and deep pile of something he assumed, hoped, was hay. While he was excited about the possibility of seeing Eliza again, he was also too tired to care about the indignity of a colonel and aide-de-camp to General Washington,
being forced to sleep under such circumstances, and burrowed deeper into the hay. The sweet smell of straw filled his nostrils,